Vitamin C has evolved. Altrient Vitamin C is a cutting-edge liposomal liquid food supplement designed for maximized absorption. Discover Altrient Liposomal Vitamin C and receive 10% discount by quoting HR10 at abundanceandhealth.com.
Hi, and welcome to the Yes Life Show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, and I'm the founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that's working to make integrative medicine the standard of care in oncology in the UK. My guest on the show this week needs little introduction. Patrick Holford is a household name in the UK and many other countries, well known for his work in promoting nutrition and nutritional science, and for his astonishing output of dozens of books on the subject. I'm talking to Patrick over the internet at his home in southwest London. Patrick, great to have you back on the show.
Pleasure to be here.
I looked it up, and it's more than 5 years ago that you were last on, so you're well overdue for another appearance.
Thank you.
So we just completed a weekend looking into nutritional science and cancer at our Spring Congress. And what strikes me most from the event is just what a different scene it is to, say, 5 years ago when we last chatted on the Yes Life Show. So while we can't really say yet that our healthcare system's brimming with nutritional therapists, even though it's starting to look like it could happen, the concept of food as medicine and of keeping resilient and healthy with good nutrition and exercise has surely arrived. And it's even considered normal, a kind of everyday concept these days. The fact, of course, that it was ever otherwise is only thanks to the commercial interests that infiltrated our food supply and our regulatory bodies and everywhere else. But I think it's fair to say that you played a significant role in this revolution in attitudes. What got you interested in nutrition in the first place?
Well, I was a psychologist back in the 80s, and I had late 70s, I had two areas of interest. One was intelligence. I figured if we could have more intelligence, it would be better.
That's good.
I saw in one of my posts recently, someone said, shame there isn't a vaccine against stupidity. I thought that was quite good. And the other was actually schizophrenia, mental illness.
Right.
And the schizophrenia journey was really what got me into nutrition originally, because I came across what we were taught to look for, which was double-blind, randomized, controlled placebo trial on B vitamins versus placebos for schizophrenia. And the results were really excellent. I later learned that this research carried out by Professor Abram Hoffer, who was the head of psychiatric research for Canada, was actually the first ever randomized placebo-controlled trial in the history of psychiatry. So
really?
A couple of years later, yeah, really.
Wow.
You know, it started there. And it's funny, actually, that you say that, because recently I'm studying an incredibly boring but important book on clinical trials. And it says the first clinical trial was actually done in 1747 by James Lind on limes and scurvy.
Right, right.
So that means we got 260 years of clinical trials on vitamin C. So nutrition's kind of led the way in science.
It has.
And anyway, to cut a long story short, I went and trained with Dr. Abram Hoffer and then later with Dr. Linus Pauling, an extraordinary man that I'm sure we'll talk about, because his impact on cancer has been immense. And, you know, soon, I remember, you know, many years ago in the early 80s, driving down a hill in Buckinghamshire and having this sort of outrageous, radical idea that could it be that suboptimum nutrition is the driver of all these diseases, from diabetes, heart disease, you know, mental illness. And, you know, people don't understand that back in those days, if you said what you eat has an effect upon your intelligence.
Yeah, I know.
Which
was
in fact
really radical.
You know, you'd say, you're crazy. You know, it'd be crazy.
Yeah.
And then the idea that what you eat has an impact upon cancer, you say, you know, what? Mm. And it wasn't, you know, Jeffrey Cannon, you'll remember, did phenomenal work trying and eventually getting the massive tome of consensus statements from the World Cancer Research Fund and others to really show the massive link between diet and cancer. So it was all of that territory that, you know, that got me started. And I think even now, I just did a post on which was called "Vaccines: the elephant in the room" in relation to COVID. And you know, when you realize that diabetes and heart disease and cancer and dementia, all of these diseases are really a function of creating the wrong environment for our cells to live in. So the critical question is, what turns a healthy cell into a cancer cell? There is another question, which is what kills a cancer cell.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you don't actually address what turns a healthy cell into a cancer cell, you're not in the right ballpark. And, you know, the obvious question in relation to COVID, which, you know, finally our experts are kind of saying, hey, I'm going to be in charge of health, because what they've noticed, the Daily Mail made this very clear using NHS figures, that 388 people under the age of 60 without a comorbidity or health condition have died. 388 right. In Britain. That's the total.
Right.
So, you know, the experts are sort of noticing, it's very strange. Healthy people don't seem to be getting COVID very badly at all, if at all. Most are asymptomatic. And unhealthy people do. So we've got to make everybody healthy. You know, so the Genius. Talking is there.
Yeah.
Not really the doing, because as I often say to doctors, what's your model of health? What were you taught in medical school about what health is? You know, and the answer really is nothing. One is taught how to treat a disease, but there is no model of health.
No,
and that's why, you know, so many of these so-called experts sort of struggle to cross that line of actually doing something in the area of generating resilience.
Right, right. They haven't got the toolkit. So back then, you're getting interested in nutrition, and you started getting out there a bit. And I'm just interested, who was your audience back then? Who was listening to the Food as Medicine message 20 or more years ago?
Well, it sort of happened for me in two ways. And I'll tell you, this is not completely in sequence, but it's fairly close. I had a very important meeting with Geoffrey Cannon, a very important journalist, and also with Dr. Stephen Davies, who started Biolab and the yeah. British Society of Nutritional Medicine.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, you know, one of those jokes of the Welshman, Irishman, Englishman sort of thing. But, right. You know, Geoffrey Cannon said, nothing's going to change until we change the system. You know, we've got to be getting governmental change, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And he went off to work with some, you know, very eminent, you know, large-scale organizations around the world. And he did, you know, he did make some impact. And then Stephen Davies said, we are talking here simply about good medicine. We're talking about evidence-based medicine. And doctors are in the business of treating people with evidence-based medicine. So he set off, you know, to train the doctors. He thought this nutritional medicine should just be part of medicine. And I sort of said, well, you know, I'm not sure that either of those things are going to work. You know, I mean, it's great. I agree with you. It's fantastic. But I'm not sure that either of them are going to work. So I'm going to focus on two things. One is creating a new profession called nutritional therapists, who people can see. And I actually was the first nutrition consultant. That was the title I gave myself. And we're going to get out to people. We think it's people that change the system, not the system that changes the people. You have to have enough groundswell. And so in 84, I founded the Institute for Optimum Nutrition. And my first enrollment was 73 people to train as nutritional therapists.
That's quite a lot.
They were my
good start.
Yeah. And we've now got, yeah, it's not a bad start. We've now got 10,000. And I wrote a book in 81 before this on the first Apple II computer,
you know,
with the floppy drives.
Yeah.
You know,
I was there,
and my friend was an artist, and he did the Letraset. Remember Letraset?
Oh,
where you
I
rub
do.
The Letraset,
yeah.
You know, with the chapter headings. I had in today's money the equivalent of £1,000, and I went to a printer and said, how many to print 10,000, you know, this is equivalent today. And he said 3,000. And I said, well, if I give you £1,000 in 30 days and £1,000 in 60 days and £1,000 in 90 days, can we play ball? And he said, yes.
Wow.
So I got in my I got in my £3,000 Skoda, I think it was, and whizzed around the country, literally knocking on radio shows. And anyway, I sold 8,000 copies in the next 6 months. Oh. And then Thorson's, HarperCollins, pitched up, now HarperCollins, pitched up on my doorstep and said, we'd like to publish your book, which they did, and that sold a quarter of a million. So that was the sort of, that was the origin of it. And I'm delighted to know that there are so many brilliant nutritional therapists out there making a noise. And the point is, gradually they've joined in a lot of charities, a lot of different groups. So there is this sort of almost unspoken. I mean, I have to say, I think at least a quarter of the population now are very much in alignment with the kind of things that we're talking about.
I think you're right.
And and now the problem is joining the dots. So, you know, if somebody gets diagnosed with cancer, it's not they don't want to do this thing. But it's just how do I talk to my oncologist about this? You know, where do I get, you know, this test done? You know, how can I get this situation managed? So we're kind of beyond the early innovation stage.
Yeah.
I remember back in those days, it was a fair criticism to say, where's the evidence? You know, there wasn't so much evidence. But now there's, I mean, I just published a paper with some brilliant colleagues and professors on vitamin C and COVID. And, you know, we got 120 research papers. I mean, there's plenty of evidence. So now it's not necessarily about the evidence. It's still, of course, about educating the public. That's terribly important. But it's about joining the dots and how people can get the treatment, you know, based on nutrition and lifestyle that they deserve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's we're working hard at trying to join a few dots ourselves. So I hope that's all going to happen. Yeah. Great. So food's had a pretty rough ride throughout the 20th century. I mentioned those commercial interests that were key factors in it. It was kind of unfortunate for the public that two of the biggest sectors of industry, that's food and pharma, and that's not the agricultural kind, the other kind of pharma, both had a keen interest in severing any kind of perceived link between food and health, although they had different reasons for it. You know, the food industry, they wanted to place commercial interest above all the others and get away with changing natural foods into profitable products. While in the pharmaceuticals, they were, I think nutrition was basically represented a risk to their bottom line, you know, cheap, unpatentable competition. So your strong stance in support of nutrition for health has meant that you've received more than your fair share of criticism and even abuse over the years. Would you share a little of what your experience has been and tell us if you now feel fundamentally vindicated in holding out for food as generally the best medicine?
Yeah, Wendell Berry said, people are fed by the food industry, which pays no attention to health, and are treated by the health industry, which pays no attention to food.
Yeah, right.
I thought
that's quite nicely ties it up.
I thought that was very nice, yeah. I mean, I'm a sort of strange character. I'm just interested. There isn't a day when I'm not studying something, so I'm just interested in, you know, where roads lead. And one of my absolute heroes is the late Dr. Linus Pauling, who, right, in case you don't know about him, you should, because if you know about Einstein, you should know about Pauling. You see, what happened was Einstein was a friend of Linus Pauling. And Linus, in fact, when Einstein was asked, are you a genius? He said, if you want a real genius, it's Linus Pauling. Because Linus Pauling understood absolutely what Einstein was saying, applied it to chemistry, and got his first Nobel Prize for a very important piece of work called The Nature of the Chemical Bond, which changed all of chemistry. He got his second one as a Peace Prize, Nobel Peace Prize, because he took over Einstein's campaigning against nuclear bomb testing. Mm. And when the treaty banning nuclear bomb testing, global treaty, was finally passed, he got a second Nobel Prize. By the time I met him, he had 48 PhDs. He was the first guy to work out how he really could have got the Nobel Prize for the structure of DNA. Mm. But because of his peace activism, he was grounded. He had his passport confiscated, and he couldn't get to Oxford to meet this French scientist, Madeleine, who had a clue from her experiments. So Watson and Crick got there, and Pauling guessed slightly wrong. And they were absolutely frightened that if they got Madeleine's data, he'd beat them to it. He then worked out how a gene causes disease. So that was the very first thing. That was the origin of understanding genetic impact on disease. He then worked out how the environment turns genes on or off, epigenetics.
I didn't know that.
You know? Mm. Yeah, which is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And then he came across my other teacher, Dr. Abram Hoffer, who had already treated thousands of schizophrenic patients successfully. And the story goes that a man came to be treated, to have his son treated by Abram Hoffer in Canada. The son got better from his schizophrenia. The father was so delighted, he bought 50 copies of Abram Hoffer's book, took it back to Carmel, California, delivered a copy to every doctor in the county. Linus Book had been invited to tea by one of the doctors, saw the book, started reading it. And then he became fascinated in the very simple fact that animals that make vitamin C, which is basically all animals except for primates, bats, guinea pig doesn't, there's just a few that don't, basically don't get cancer. Right? It's just incredibly low incidence of cancer. Mm. And animals who make vitamin C also don't get viral diseases. You know, that's why we don't mind about our dogs and cats and sheep and goats getting coronavirus. They're immune because they make vitamin C.
Right.
And, you know, it's so fascinating. And also, when you look at it, vitamin C is very, very close to sugar chemically. And basically, it's a very old molecule. Ever since oxygen-based life forms existed running on glucose, we would have had to have had vitamin C as the exhaust fume mopper upper, you know, the antioxidant. And he got so fascinated, he spent the last 39 years of his life on nothing but vitamin C research.
Wow. Yeah.
And before he died, I was actually the last man to film him. And I filmed him on a new theory he had. He was lying in bed, a couple of months to live. Prostate cancer got him in the end. We had a bit of a row at one point about milk, I have to tell you. I wasn't greatly in favor, and he was from that generation where, you know, milk's a fantastic thing. And and he had a whole new theory on what's called lipoprotein A and heart disease and vitamin C, which is now a very, very hot topic. And sharp as a razor, absolutely amazing. And almost his parting words to me is, don't worry about the randomized controlled trials, follow the logic. It's the logic that counts. So I've been following the logic. You know, back in the early 90s, we had the logic of dairy products driving breast and prostate cancer. You know, I got hung, drawn and quartered for that, no question about it. So, you know, and like right now, to give you a simple example of logic, the adrenal glands store vitamin C. They have 100 times more vitamin C equivalent than any other part of the body.
Okay.
And when you are exposed to a stress, which includes a virus, and, you know, like this sepsis and COVID, the adrenal glands actually release vitamin C into your bloodstream and raise blood levels up to 20 times higher. And a chemical that is stored in an endocrine gland that is released into the bloodstream that then does things, in this case, it's very powerful anti-inflammatory, is called a hormone. So vitamin C is a hormone, and it works with steroids, that is cortisol. That's the adrenal hormone that is part of our fight-flight system.
Right.
And in essence, the primary reason why people are dying of COVID is not the virus. If they don't get rid of the viral infection long enough, and they have lots of dead viral particles floating around in their lungs, particularly, and also in the blood, the immune system attacks, which is called sepsis, and it goes into this hyperdrive situation. And normally, the adrenals would release cortisol and vitamin C to calm the whole thing down.
Right.
But if you've had 2 weeks of viral infection, you've got no vitamin C left. So the whole adrenal response doesn't work. And that's why the hospitals that are using intravenous steroids with intravenous vitamin C are basically having no deaths in anyone under the age of 85. And no one over the age of 85 who doesn't have an end-stage disease. So, you know, we're talking about mortality rates of 4 or 5% compared to the, you know, up to 40% that we're seeing right now. But the point is, I haven't yet quoted a science study. Of course, I could. The point is the logic of it. So, you know, when you know the body's adrenal glands store vitamin C and release it, you know, you have to ask why.
Right.
And that's what I've been following is the logic. And funny enough, my major attack, I've had quite a few, but the major one, in 1992 and 1993, Linus Pauling and a brilliant immunologist, Raxit Jariwala, took HIV, you know, had arrived in the late 80s. They took human T cells, infected them with the AIDS virus, HIV, exposed them to vitamin C, just like we've seen with cancer cells, totally non-toxic to the cell, but the vitamin C eradicated the virus by 99.8% in 4 days, right, with a massive antiviral effect. They then did a study that compared it to the best drug at the time, AZT, and it was many times more effective. My immediate response, if you remember Tomorrow's World,
I do,
you know, was to ring up Tomorrow's World and say, here's an incredible story, you know, here's an incredible piece of science. Of course, they ignored it. And I put it in one of my books. And then in the late 90s, at some point, I started to get attacked for this outrageous idea that vitamin C has got something beneficial to say about AIDS. And funny enough, what happened was I was writing a chapter that was talking about the terrain or the host. You know, are we just trying to kill a cancer cell? Or do we look at the environment that has created that possibility? And I said vitamin C had outperformed AZT. What I didn't say, this was my mistake, in cell studies. Right?
Yeah.
So I didn't, you know. And I referenced the first study on vitamin C and HIV, but not the follow-up that compared it to AZT. And the funniest version of this, I then wrote a book with one of your trustees, Jerome Byrne.
All right.
Which was really around the essay title of "Is Food Better Medicine Than Drugs for Chronic Diseases?" You know, so we were comparing what you can do with food and nutrients and magnesium and omegas with heart disease versus drugs and so on, and nothing about AIDS at all. And then I went to South Africa to launch the book there, got off the plane and was handed a demand, got off the plane from a group called the Campaign Against Fraudulent Claims in Medicine.
Right.
A number of professors, generally pharmacologists, all with links to Big Pharma, who were demanding Holford not say this, this, this. You know, it was very nasty. And also kind of claiming that I'd come to South Africa to kill people with this idea that vitamin C cures AIDS, which I wasn't doing at all. You know, what do you do? I mean, it's literally been sent to every TV station, radio station, you know, et cetera, right, et cetera. So I got on the taxi on the way to the hotel room. I created an equally bogus organization, which was called the Campaign for Ridiculing Atrocious Press Mongering. And mine I abbreviated to CRAP. And theirs, which was the Campaign Against Claims on Medicine, I just was very, very long. I thought I'd just call it CAC. So I sent out a press release, which was CAC on crap, you know, CAC being crap in South Africa, and answered all the points. And said journalists can interview me about anything. They can ask about my salary, my money, my inside leg measurement, my relationships, anything you like. But the condition of an interview is you just give me the time to go through the science to answer your questions. And we did lots of interviews, and it went from a hostile environment into a positive environment. The book went to number two, and we sort of turned the thing around.
That was
but,
nice.
You know, I've been burgled, I've been followed, I've been photographed, I've been sued, I've sued back. I hope those days are over, but you know, there's quite a lot of fight, you know, just to get to the point that we are at right now.
It's scary, isn't it? This whole sort of fight thing that, you know, oppositional medicine, which has seemed to be a good thing, you know, the sciences where, you know, you have to be robust and kick each other's science to bits. That's what you're supposed to do, rather than collaborating to find out the best answer. It's scary, really. And, you know, one of the things that always strikes me is if you look at exercise, which has not really got any corporations involved, it's made the kind of progress in medicine that nutritionists can only dream about. Within just a very few years, it's completely changed the advice from lying in bed doing nothing, taking the chemo, to, you know, pedaling while you're having it, you know. And this could never happen with nutrition, only because there are so many vested interests. And look how fast things could move if there weren't those vested interests.
No, it's very true. And the thing that starts to kind of open up the can of worms to some extent is, you know, the advances, for example, in chemosensitivity testing, which is now becoming a little bit more mainstream, and focusing quite a lot on measuring circulating tumor cells, you know, the cells that break away from primary tumors and start, you know, secondaries and so on. And I've been working with a girl down in Cornwall who had a rather aggressive breast cancer. And through nutrition, not only nutrition, she also had a, you know, the equivalent of a sort of chemically induced menopause, you know, dropped the estrogen levels down, but her tumor shrank, you know, to a fifth of its size. And then they were able to operate and there was very little residue, but they sent her test results off to the States to actually look at, you know, in more detail at the genetics of it and, you know, the levels of CTCs and all the rest of it. And to make the decision whether or not she would benefit from chemo. And the decision was she didn't need to. And the interesting thing is when you do start, you know, doing the chemosensitivity testing, like, you know, I quite like the laboratory RGCC, and you find, drugs that are effective, and you find nutrients that are effective, and you look at the mechanism of the drugs. Some of the drugs use a quinazoline ring, which is what you find in curcumin and turmeric. You find it in quercetin and red onions. Other drugs are essentially oxidizing, kind of burning with oxygen in a way. And we all know about the value of oxygen and, you know, hyperbaric oxygen and all that sort of thing. And then you find the vitamin C in very high dose, probably only achievable intravenously, is a prooxidant. So it also, it's the same mechanism. So when you get closer and closer and closer, it gets really hard in the same way that, you know, Tamiflu, which was the great dream drug for, you know, for swine flu, is a neuraminidase inhibitor. And when we hear of all these viruses, H1N1, H5N1, or whatever it is, the N stands for neuraminidase. It's one of the spikes. Mm. Okay. We've all heard about spikes, and the other one is hemagglutinin. And then you find the vitamin C is a neuraminidase inhibitor. You know, that's one of its 12 functions. Mm. So the good news, in a way, is all the tremendous advances that pharmaceutical medicine has brought into understanding the minutiae of chemistry and biochemistry is the same language. You know, we don't have to be talking, meridians in acupuncture.
Right. Right.
It's exactly the same language.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of good news. But as you say, the big problem is very simply, you can only patent something you can man make, and you can't man make a nutrient. They already exist. So you've generally got to look at something that blocks something. And I think the big, this isn't a pro or anti-vaccine comment, but the big thing that people don't realize is about a decade ago, the major pharma companies went on record in various meetings as basically saying, we can't make money out of blockbuster drugs. Statins was the last cash cow. It's off patent. It's dirt cheap. So a drug has a period of time, maybe 15 years, where you can hype up the price, spend a lot on marketing, get a lot of sales, up in the tens of billions of dollars annual sales. And there's nothing in the pipeline. This has been a long time coming. There was a scramble, or is a scramble, to find a drug for dementia. And it's totally failed. I mean, billions of dollars have been spent to try and find a drug to treat dementia. And the best drug to date has reduced brain shrinkage in those with pre-dementia by 2%. And we, when I say we, my colleagues at Oxford University, using B vitamins and sufficient omega-3, have reduced brain shrinkage by 73%, with 30% of people no longer having a clinical dementia rating at the end of a year versus no clinical effect for the drug. So it's like chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
And so they've run out of blockbuster drugs, which have got to block something. So they decided that the money was in vaccines. And there's sort of two agendas going on here. One is, you know, how to deal with COVID, but the other is how to create a total environment thinking within government and all the rest of it that is incredibly vaccine friendly. Because, you know, they're, otherwise this $1 trillion industry hasn't really got anywhere to go. And that's why we're living in immensely interesting, you know, and political times. And once again, you know, you can kill. I mean, this is the thing that's so extraordinary, but it's also completely true for cancer as well, is normally you get a cold and your innate immune system kicks in many different ways and gets rid of it before you've learnt to recognize it and produce targeted antibodies. So that's called your acquired or learnt immunity. You've got your innate immunity and your acquired or learnt immunity. So when you do vaccines, you are trying to get a learnt immunity. And nothing wrong with that as a concept at all. But what about the innate immunity? You know, that's like, that's not only your first defense, but I mean, it's at least half of all immunity. So right. it's the same with cancer. You've got a cancer cell and you want to, you know, kill it in some way. But what you know, normally your immune system should recognize an aberrant cell, you know, take it out and deal with the situation. So, you know, that's the other half. The trouble with the other half is you can't patent it. You know, there's no money you can make out of it. And it's a real tragic situation that actually our medicine is principally being deviated for profit.
Always. Well, you know. Certainly for well over 100 years anyway. So completely agree. That's it's followed the money every time. It's a shame. Yeah, I mean, people do have the idea that here we are in Britain with its lovely sort of free healthcare service that's not really built around profit and everything. But still, the medicines are, in fact. And so that's what we're getting. We're getting things that make money. And it's a tragedy. Yeah, you're right. The whole concept of health promotion doesn't exist because it's nothing to do with drugs, essentially. And but nonetheless, it is beginning to appear, as we've noted. And COVID has actually helped us along, curiously. I think the awareness of this fact that it's sick people who die from COVID, not robust, healthy people, has actually sunk in. And so I think it is providing a bit of a leg up to the whole idea of creating wellness, of maintaining health. So let's hope there's lots more of that. So coming back round to where we started with nutritional science and cancer, well, so you don't specialise in cancer, but I'm delighted to say that very many people do these days. But you've looked into the area quite a lot, clearly. Two editions of your book, Say No to Cancer, provided direction for a huge number of people with cancer. And I think they probably inspired a lot of people to train and specialise too. So, incredibly, it was first published at the end of the last century, I noticed, which I wonder, could you summarise the changes that have occurred in the field of nutrition and cancer in this last couple of decades from your perspective?
Well, yes. And in a way, it's a bit like the whole COVID thing. There's one is the things that you can do to prevent or create an environment in which cells do not become cancer cells. And, you know, it started back from smoking to eating organic. You know, we know the importance of eating organic. You know, there's very specific reasons for that, reducing your chemical load, you know, good nutrients and all the rest of it. But then the second half, which I think is really the fascinating one, is how specific agents within foods have, if you like, you know, sometimes chemotherapy effects, sometimes growth inhibiting effects, you know, but very specific and very targeted effects. And it's sort of similar with this whole COVID thing. You see, vitamin C is a real exception. It's not, I mean, it is a nutrient, but as I've already said, all animals make it and they make a lot of it when they need to. So it's a different beast, vitamin C. And I think that the evidence for high dose intravenous vitamin C, not for all cancers, but for certain cancers, as a chemotherapy agent, it's quite separate to its immune boosting, antioxidant, you know, effects. Yeah. It is really, really fascinating. I think the other area that's really come to the fore, we've been pushing vitamin D for 20 years, but I think we had the dose too low. And all of the studies more recently on immunity show that you want to get your level up to 100 nanomoles per liter, and you're not going to do that by eating a, you know, a couple of mackerel a week.
Right.
So so those two nutrients have really sort of shone as very multifaceted, very, very important. So it isn't just, you know, eat a well-balanced diet. That's the point here. Mm. There are certain compounds. I mean, I think curcumin, which is now in many bioavailable forms, is showing some, you know, fantastic concepts. And then my sort of latest piece of work, which is a book called The Five-Day Diet, is about how to switch on the process called autophagy, or self-eating. That when you fast, your body obviously has to stop consuming sugars, which in most cases are very cancer-friendly, and switch into burning your body fat, which produces ketones. So you go onto a ketogenic diet. But also it switches on a self-repair process called autophagy. And it's important to note that if you go on the Atkins diet, you eat lots of meat and lots of cheese and no carbs, you will go ketogenic, but you won't go autophagic. You don't switch on the repair process.
Mm.
And and then when you, if you just put in autophagy and cancer, for example, you suddenly find that so many of these frontiers, whether it be vitamin C, vitamin D, curcumin, you know, Artemisia, whatever, you know, there's so many, you'll find that the measure of their sort of anti-cancer effect is by switching on autophagy, which eats up the cancer cells.
Hmm.
So in other words, it's highlighting that our body has a mechanism for dealing with cancer, which is very bound into this self-repair mechanism. And what nutrients do is they switch that on. So I think that's a frontier.
Maybe could you just say a little bit more about why the Atkins diet doesn't do this and other low-carb diets do?
Yeah, I mean, Professor Voltolongo from California has been, you know, very much leading this. And he really showed, you know, a lot of us were sort of into modified fasting. Maybe you don't eat for a day, or you have the 18-6 where you have dinner at 6 and lunch at 12. So you've got 18 hours not eating, or the 5-2 diet, Michael Mosley and so on. All of which have all sorts of merits. But what Professor Voltolongo found was that you don't actually switch on this autophagic self-repair cancer cell eating mitochondria, that's the energy factory replacement, by any of those, because they're not long enough. It takes about 3 days of fasting to switch on autophagy. And then what he showed was actually, if you don't have to fast completely, but you do have to drop calories down to about 800 calories, and you do have to drop protein down to about 20 grams, and it mustn't be meat protein or milk protein, because milk's job is to make things grow. So dairy products tell your system to go into growth mode. That's what they do. So yesterday I was holding my little granddaughter, you know, 2 weeks old. She's in growth mode. She's making ketones. Most of her energy is actually from ketones, not from glucose, both from her own body fat, babies are born chubby, and from the breast milk, which has lots of fat in it.
Mm.
She's in a growth phase. So generally meat and milk say growth. And if you're doing one of these fasting, mimicking 5-day, it takes 3 days to switch on autophagy, and 5 days is sort of, you know, the process. If you're, you know, so if you don't have to starve, this is really important. And that's this new territory, how to switch on autophagy. Now, by the way, in animal studies, I mean, I got fascinated because in animal studies, his group is showing reversal of autoimmune disease, like type 1 diabetes, where you've lost the ability to make insulin. You've no longer got beta cells in your pancreas. Animals put on this 5-day process 4 times. So usually 5 days on, 10 days off, 5 days on, 4 times, are making insulin. They're remaking beta cells, remaking insulin. So this is because they're remaking stem cells. They're actually making stem cells, a very base cell from which we make healthy cells. And to give an example, in a recent study with mice, this was in relation to cancer. KRAS, you'll know, is a rather sort of aggressive colon cancer-related, you know, process. And what they did was to put animals onto nothing, and the tumor grew, onto this five-day diet. They actually did it three times, and the tumor growth shrunk by about a third. Or they had another group on high-dose vitamin C. It also shrank the tumor growth by a third. Or the fourth group did both, the five-day diet three times plus the high-dose vitamin C, and that shrunk the tumor growth by over two-thirds. And I think that in almost in exactly the same way that we have created an environment that has allowed our cells to be so poorly nourished that they are reverting to an earlier life form based on fermenting sugar, a sort of anaerobic type of metabolism. We, you know, which is quite an extreme thing to have happen. We now have to do the reverse, which is to create an extreme environment that triggers the immune system, triggers autophagy, and actually reverses that process. And that's kind of, you know, where I'm at in thinking about, you know, the sort of general concept of cancer. And what I love, I mean, your charity, Yes to Life, have done such a brilliant job in this space. I think, and you have great resources, phone numbers you can ring and all the rest of it, which is fantastic. And you mentioned that there are lots of nutritionists now who are sort of starting to work a bit more strongly in this area, because I believe you need a switched on oncologist and a great nutritionist to support them. Of course, there are some integrative oncologists who do both. But even the best, it's not quite true, but, you know, some of these integrative oncologists, they sort of have learned what to do with the nutrition, but they've never studied it in the depth to really understand the why. So, and that was my argument with Stephen Davis at the beginning of our conversation, is that doctors just won't have 3 years to study nothing but nutrition. They're just too busy. And that's why I wanted to create this other nutritional therapist to work with oncologists, to work with doctors.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think one thing we lack right now, I don't know the answer to this question, maybe you do, maybe it's something for the future, is if someone says, I want to work with a nutritionist who's sort of, you know, cancer-oriented, maybe has done some training, whatever it is, I don't really know where to send them. I happen to know a couple. But of course, there are many more. So having some sort of directory of nutritionists who are willing to support someone, and I know we have legalities here, so that's what they're doing. They're supporting someone who are being treated, you know, by their oncologist. They're not treating them as such. We're not allowed to say that. I think that would be, you know, those are the two pieces, a switched-on oncologist and a switched-on nutritionist.
You know, absolutely agree. Well, I got good news for you on both those fronts. First one is that when you need to refer someone to a nutritionist who's got experience with supporting people with cancer, you tell them to look in our directory on our website, which has got many of them in there. And the only reason they're in there is because they do support people with cancer. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I've just launched a new podcast where it's jointly hosted between myself and a senior NHS oncologist. And we're talking to people like nutritionists. So the people who are, you know, you're started their legacy here. Those are the kind of people we're talking to about the potential that there is inherent in combining these forces. So, you know, this is with a view to promoting interest in integrative medicine. So, you know, I hope that's going to start a small revolution. We could do with one.
That's great news. That's really, really good. Yeah, well done. I run a charity, Food for the Brain. Well, I'm now a trustee. I know what it's like. We're endlessly scrambling for some funds just to keep going.
Tell me. Yeah.
It's not a question of demand. There's loads of demand.
It's
just how do you keep these things going? And I don't know whether you've had any government support, but we certainly haven't had any.
No, not really. I mean, it's at the beginning of the pandemic, there was a bit of a flurry of money for charities, which we did manage to get some of, but that's long dried up now, and into the stark times at the moment. You know, we're just hand to mouth. And so, yeah, what to do? It's very hard. I think it's hard for all charities at the moment, except for the ones that have got a massive bank account. Yeah, it's a tough environment. Anyway, on we go. We've got lots to do. Do you have to keep going?
We do.
All right, look, we're out of time. That's really interesting talk, Patrick. Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me. Keep spreading the word.
And let's make it less than 5 years next time.
Okay, it's a deal.
Cheers.
Cheers. All the best.
Bye. You can find out more about Patrick and his work at patrickholford.com and more about the BSIO at bsio.org.uk. And if you're a professional interested in integrative medicine for cancer, do check out the Integrative Oncology UK 2021 event at integrativeoncologyuk.com. I'm very pleased to let you know that the video recordings of our extraordinarily successful Congress on Nutritional Science and Cancer are now available. Take a look on yestolifeconference.org.uk to see what's on offer. Many thanks for joining me today. I'll be back next week with more discussion of important factors around cancer and integrative oncology in the next Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.